Okay, thank you. Thank you everybody for joining us. We are in our last session. It's plenary four. The topic is very important. It's on strategic thinking, leadership, and personal brand. And we've got an amazing lineup of speakers today. Before I start to introduce them, I just wanted to reflect on Jefferson's speech around communication, because I found that very inspiring. And I think one of the things he asks us to do is to act on something, do something very differently. So I think this is the last session of the day. And what I'll ask you to do is, as you listen to these panel speakers, this topic is very important to actuaries and brand actuary, if you like. So as you listen to the speakers, note down the question that you want to ask. And what I'm going to do is, at the end, if you haven't had a chance to speak out yet, I'd just like to encourage you, in the same way that Jefferson encouraged you, put up your hand, ask your question, because I promise you, whatever question you're asking, there's probably 10 of you out there who has a very, very similar question. So this is a great time to practice that. So please just note that. So my name is Trang Duncanson. I work at Deloitte. I am on the organising committee for this. I am very passionate about it. At Deloitte, I'm actually in charge of talent development for actuaries. So this is absolutely the thing I love doing, and I do that on top of the everyday technical advisory work that I do. The other thing I do is I have the privilege of being the chief editor of the Actuaries Digital Magazine. So at our drinks, I'm very happy to talk to any of you who would like to write an article for Actuaries Magazine. And we do have an actuarial editorial committee around us who can give you ideas. And it's also a very great way for you guys to profile yourself and to practice having a point of view. So this session, as I said, strategic thinking, leadership, personal brand. So you would have heard from Mark quite early on that our training exposes ourselves to many of the stewardship and the operational aspects of the role of an actuary. Now, one of the hardest things to do is to actually make that leap to become a strategic advisor. And you do need that critical skill to be able to have a seat at the table. So this whole thing, the Institute of Actuaries, is very, very keen on for all of us, and which is why we run so many of these leadership forums for all of you. So we've got a great lineup, as I said, of speakers today who have a lot of experience in providing strategic advice to the business. So I think one of you on the floor asked the question, how do you get into strategy? And Nicolette was talking about a specific strategy role. So, and that those roles are actually very few and far in between. Now, you don't have to be a head of strategy. You don't have to work in a strategy team. But inside an actuarial function, you can provide strategic advice. And in fact, it's very important that we provide strategic advice to the rest of the business. So the first speaker I would like to introduce is Darren Robinson. Now, he's sent through to the Institute a whole blurb about himself, but I've replaced that with my own notes because I know Darren very well. Now, the others are pretty safe because I'm going to follow your blurb. But Darren I've known for almost two decades, so I'm sort of giving away our age. Darren, sorry. But he's the chief actuary of MLC Insurance. And if you know anything about MLC, it's gone through an amazing amount of change, particularly in the last 3 years with the Nippon transaction. So it's been very, very exciting for Darren, as well as the actuarial function there. So we spent 3 years working together at MLC during that time, and there were so many transformational projects happening during that time. Hitting the actuarial function was absolutely amazing. And you've got to remember, a normal actuarial function has a significant workload that is BAU as well. So we were hit with all of these other very strategic projects that we needed to support the business, as well as Nippon, to be able to enact. And that transaction did happen last September. And As I said, all I can say is during that time, anything that we were doing for the business, I can only categorise as strategic advisory work. So that's why we've got Darren here to speak to you about that, to give you some of his experience around that. The other thing I should note is during that time that Darren took that leadership role, there was so much hitting that team that he had to create another team within his team called, and he called it a SWAT team. Now Kitty's here today, and she's part of the SWAT team. But from a professional perspective, what I did advise Darren was maybe we'll just call it the Office of the Chief Actuary. But internally, it is actually called the SWAT team, so, which is great. The other thing I should say about Darren is he is about to present at the summit on the topic of scrums and sprints and using agile. And again, because we were going through this massive, massive change at that time, it did mean that we had to create a very agile way of working. So Darren will present at the summit on that. So that is my introduction for Darren, ignore the rest. I should also say he's got a long history in the life insurance industry. He's worked at BT, at Clearview, at Commonsure. And why I know all this, and you should know all this, because if you search for him on LinkedIn, he has four profiles. But the one you should link to is the Chief Actuary of MLC Insurance, because that's the latest one. So, Darren, strategic leadership.
Thanks, Trang. And the reason I've got four profiles is I'm not particularly good at technology. And the first thing we're going to do is try to use some technology. So what I'm going to get you to do is, just to wake you up a little bit, take out your phone, go to respond.cc, type in the session key, and then tell me what you think strategy is. Hopefully we won't need this session. And then press submit. And when you do that, it'll come up as little post-its on the screen shortly. Have you got that number? 999-168. That's the one you need. What is strategy, according to you? And there'll be a million versions. After typing what? You can type it in any language you like. All right, let's see what we've got. There we go. Work harder, not smarter. Breathe. Someone's been listening to the communication session. Innovation. Working out what to do. Direction. Understanding the best possible way to reach a goal, a plan given by people, to people, overarching direction, evidence-backed advice, vision, achieving something with the minimum possible effort, creating value, vision, GPS, a goal, planning, profit, what you use to win war, thinking, failing to plan is planning to fail. It's getting deep now. Hi, someone's testing that it's working. Tactics. Some would say tactics is before strategy. Ways to achieve. There we go. A million different options. Work harder, not smarter. That's the first one up there. All right. Thanks for that. So what is strategy? Before we get into that, what I'm going to talk to today about is Strategy 101. So this is what the textbooks tell you to do. I'm going to talk about some of the strategic issues facing the life industry at the moment. I'm going to talk about some of the assets that we as within a life company has. And it sounds very life specific, but actually what you'll find is a lot of these things are quite generic, particularly the strategy part and the last part, when I'm going to talk about your personal strategy. So first of all, good strategy, according to Boston Consulting Group, is achieving a competitive advantage. And this is quite different from being the best. A lot of people interpret strategy as how do you get to be the best? But actually, in a competitive industry, there is no best. If you look at, for example, the car industry, Mercedes make a great car, but it's actually not suitable for the buyers of Hyundai. So within what Boston Consulting Group is talking about here is how do you come up with something that's unique for you? And when you have that, you can create a competitive advantage. And this is something that your competitors can't replicate. And it's the ability to satisfy customer needs or produce something at a lower cost then competitors. And ultimately, Boston Consulting Group, so it's all focused on shareholder value. How do you get there? These are the questions. What is our winning aspiration? And a lot of this is in consulting speak. So what I'll do is make a practical example, because the speak that they use around strategy can be a bit esoteric, but the outcomes are actually very simple and very easy to recognise. So I'm going to use IKEA as an example, just to take us away from insurance for a while. So what is our winning aspiration? So this is, what does it look like when we win? What is it that our customers and our staff say about our company? And so for IKEA, at the time that it was created, you couldn't buy affordable furniture. It was very expensive. So their offer to the market was affordable furniture. What is our winning aspiration? Second thing is, where will we play? And this means which customers will we target, which distribution channels will we sell our product through. For IKEA, it was simple. And most of good strategy answers to these questions are actually very simple. So where will we play? It's at the low-end self-service end of the market. So a very simple statement that all of the staff in IKEA know and can repeat. It's, where will we play? How will we win? This is starting to take the strategy away from the high level theory into how do we actually do it? It becomes a little bit more pragmatic now. So how will we win? And this can be complicated. There's a lot of competitive advantages that you could potentially have. What are you going to do? Are you going to sell your product cheaper than others because for some reason you can do that cheaper than others? Is there something about your product which means you can charge more than others? Is there a capital advantage that you have, a cost of capital in insurance? Is there some reinsurance benefit that you have over others? Do you have better technology? These are all the questions. For IKEA, it was fairly simple. Two things. One, simple design that's easy to mass produce, so the products are cheaper. And the other one was the flat packs. One thing about furniture is it actually costs a lot to move it from where it was made to the customer's home. And so that's why the flat pack was invented. How will we win? What capabilities must we have? This is very related to how we'll win. When you look at any particular company, there's a lot of things that they need, that a particular company needs to do. It needs to set up a set of accounts. It needs to pay people. It needs to pay its staff. And there's a lot of functions. And most of these functions, it's actually good enough to be good and okay at it, but usually there's three or four, maybe five things that it's worth being particularly good at. And so that is what this question's about. It's about, where does senior management spend its time? Where do they focus on being exceptional, being the best in the world, is the benchmark that's set for these things. So the capabilities there for IKEA have stood for a long time. And they're about those things, so mass producing things cheaply and flat packs, so you can distribute it cheaply. The last question, and this is where actuaries come in. What management systems do we need? And this is all around working out what matters. There's a lot of things you can measure, but there are usually three, four, maybe five things that if you measure those and you focus on them incessantly, drive yourself nuts about them, constantly ask about these things, talk about them every week, and become exceptionally good at it. That's what these management systems are about. So here, sorry for those who are not in the life insurance industry. Hopefully you see some parallels to the industry that you're in. But what are the strategic assets of a modern life insurance company? First thing is, life insurers need to grow. Like most companies, if you grow, you get economies of scale, expenses drop, and you can offer a cheaper price over time. So support for distribution has been historically quite important for life insurers, and it's financial, but it's also, what are the tools and the processes that we can give to distributors to help distribute our product. Second thing is underwriting, and this is an area where actuaries can add a lot of value. Underwriting is about assessing the risk. What is the chance that someone is going to claim with imperfect information? And what are the tools and the processes that you need to set up so that, as a company, you become better and better at that over time? claims management at the other end. This is the product. This is the life insurance product, and it's any insurance product. So at the end of the day, when our customers need our help and we need to pay them, we need to do that well. Historically, that's meant ticking boxes and checking whether someone was compliant, whether they should be paid or not. That's changed quite dramatically over the last 5 years across the industry, from should they be paid to how do we help them. So there's a lot of research that shows that if you're not at work, if you're disconnected from society, then you've got a much higher propensity to become depressed. And if you become depressed, it doesn't help anyone. So claims management across the industry has changed from should we pay this claim to how do we help them, which is, again, potentially a strategic asset that a company should have. Low-cost administration, this is a major issue for the industry at the moment. So we have a very long history, and that has led to significant legacy issues. And so low-cost administration means responding to that, but also providing some sort of protection. Because of the cost that we run at the moment, the life insurance industry is actually very exposed to disruption from new players. So low-cost administration is partly protection against that. And it's very related to the next thing, which is flexible administration. So again, because of those legacy issues that we have had, it's hard to make changes. Most companies, I think, have got a life cycle for a product of about a year, which is way too long in today's environment. So I've called that flexible administration and ability to react and respond rapidly. This is where actuaries come in, so information and pricing. So there's a control cycle, which you've all learned about, which starts off at underwriting, flows through to claims management, then flows into the valuation team and the experience investigation and pricing and product design. That flow is also very slow at the moment. It takes 12 months. Most companies do a 12-month experience investigation, which is actually too slow these days. And so one strategic asset that a company could have is improving that, making it monthly and daily. Clear communication. You've seen the media, you've seen what's happened over the last 6 or 12 months. A lot of that has been because of a lack of communication and a lack of customers understanding what they have bought. And so one of our jobs as actuaries is to actually help customers understand what they've purchased and what they haven't purchased. So they're the strategic assets of a life company today. And then I'll talk a little bit about the strategic assets, the strategic issues facing the industry at the moment. And there's some hard ones. And this is, you know, there aren't any technical answers to these questions, and you really need to step outside your standard training to answer these questions. And it's something that the industry is going to be grappling with for years. So one of them is, historically, life insurers have distributed products through third party and paid them to do it. Under LIFT, that's harder to do. And so the question now is, how do you support advisors and dealer groups to continue to sell our products in this environment where we can't pay them, which is something that we have done for centuries. And the other one is without vertical integration, which is, I might skip over that one actually. Supporting distribution in a social era. So there are two things here. One of them is how do we as an industry start using social media to help customers understand our products and purchase our products if that's what they're looking for. And the other angle on this is it was a question that Angela asked earlier around about microinsurance and can we help them from Australia. And one of the things that's happening is companies are being pulled apart. So there are a range of different functions that companies provide. There are some core assets that need to stay within the company. But over time, most of those other parts are going to be pulled away from the company and provided by people working by themselves or small, more agile companies. So it's how do we use those resources that are available in the social world efficiently to provide our products? Complexity and costs, which make the industry vulnerable to disruption. How do we deal to that? Typically, we put business cases together for this, and there are large systems with a lot of legacy, and the costs often run into hundreds of millions. So they become prohibitive. So this question is, how do we get around that? How do we bite the bullet and start simplifying products and simplifying our, it's not just our products, it's our systems, it's the legal structures that we work within, and make it, you know, more protected against disruption and less expensive for our customers. This last one is earning back the industry's social license. So any industry needs, particularly large industries like insurance, have got a social pact where society expects us to give something back, and there's a strong trust element here. Question is, how do we get that social license back that we are starting to lose at the moment? And that comes down to communicating well and explaining our position. So that's very quickly a quick overview of Strategy 101 and the issues facing the industry at the moment. What I'm talking about here are the strategic assets of a life actuary, and they're actually fairly generic. They connect back to the way that we communicate and the way that we develop relationships. It's loosely modelled on a model described in Trusted Advisor by David Maister that was mentioned earlier, actually. So this is something that I've done throughout my career. It's actually there was a question earlier around women and how can they use the strengths that women have within the industry, and it's actually quite connected to that. It links into the more human relation side that women do have. Okay, so the first thing is you need to know what's happening in the company, and to do that, first step is getting the data, building the tools to process that data in a reliable, robust way, and then developing the skills and the knowledge to interpret that data. So there was a question that I think Jack asked earlier around, well, what is the strategic benefits that an actuary can provide over statisticians? And this is it. So statisticians will tend to do the data and the tools very well and come up with outcomes. But what actuaries have got the benefit of doing is taking in the product knowledge, the underlying economics of the business, and relationships with the broader business, and turning that in from basic information into something that's actionable. So that's the first step, getting the data, getting the tools, and then from that, the skills and the knowledge to know what is actually happening. And the second thing is informing and advising, and I've broken this up into two parts. The first is informing, which is basically talking about the past. This is what's happened. And you typically need to do this before you move on to the advice phase. So there's a thing around credibility here, which comes from the first set, and it buys you a seat at the table for providing advice. And advice is what whoever you're talking to should do about what you're providing. And if you do all that and you have a customer focus and you care about what they care about, then you become valued. What actually happens is the first part, the data, the tools and the skills and the knowledge present you as credible or make you as credible. The inform and advise is something that occurs over time. And it's when you spend time with someone and you learn how they operate, they learn how you operate, you learn how they make decisions. And a lot of what we were talking about previously in communication is this. It's the one-on-one discussions that happen before the PowerPoint presentation occurs, so that when the PowerPoint presentation occurs, it's actually as smooth as possible and you understand how people will respond. So that's the relationship side. And the last one is a very basic thing, but it's important. It's being reliable. People don't want to ask you for something, know that you can do it, trust you because they've got a personal relationship with you, but can't be confident that in a week's time or a month's time when they need whatever they need to know that they're going to get it. So that's the reliable element, which comes from seeing whoever you're talking to as a customer and genuinely valuing what they need. So that flows through to being a trusted advisor to the business, and it buys you a seat at the table, which in most life insurance companies effectively means you become a trusted advisor to a billion-dollar business. So that's important. And I sort of call that actionable insights through information is the process, the journey that MLC has gone through over the last 3 years. Thanks, Trin.
Our next speaker is Anthony Tocca, and I haven't had a chance to meet Anthony yet, so I'll give you a bit of a background on him. He's a data scientist. That sounds very important and interesting. At CBIG Consulting, he's worked on problems across insurance, technology, telecommunications, media, and neuroscience. That'd be great if you could give us an example on that. He is an actuary, FIAA. He has an MS in analytics at the prestigious Northwestern University. He co-founded the Minerva Collective and Data Science Breakfast Meetup. And his key missions are to extend the reach and impact of data science. Hopefully you're on the Data Science Institute Actuaries Working Group as well. So welcome, Anthony.
All right, thanks. So I'm actually not here to talk about data science. So sorry if anyone's disappointed, but you're more than welcome to connect with me afterwards, and I can always point you in the right direction. So what I am here to talk about is really strategic thinking around career and around one's own personal journey. So I'm not gonna do a kind of whole motivational speaker type bit or anything like that. But I do want to kind of talk a little bit about my own journey, and then what I'm actually going to do is try kind of challenge you guys a little bit with a whole lot of questions about what I've kind of seen being, things around the future of work and around, startup culture and artificial intelligence and all that kind of stuff that I think does, I'm going to try not put my own opinions over this, but I think they're quite important to think about as you start to build your career at this juncture. So in terms of my own journey, I was an actuary within General Insurance working at PwC, great company, had a really good time there. But I found I was not super driven in what I was doing. And that's no fault of the actuarial profession or anything like that. I'm not here to knock actuaries at all. But it wasn't what I wanted to do. And I had a kind of catalyzing point where I was speaking to someone I was living with at the time, a housemate, who was an entrepreneur. And it was a Sunday, and I was like, okay, it's Sunday night, great. And he was like, oh, I can't wait to go to work tomorrow. If I'd work over the weekends if I could, I just know it's healthy not to. And I'm like, where are you coming from? He sells like air filters for horse transports or something. Like, I don't know where the kind of that passion came from. but that was his journey. And I kind of thought, there's something in that. I want to be able to get up and really want to go to work and do something that I really care about. I kind of tended to act before thinking, and I left my job at PwC. I kind of said to the partners and things, I'm going to go be an entrepreneur, watch the space. 2 months later, after having read like the entire Game of Thrones, I was like, all right, what am I going to do? what I did think I would be kind of driven by something if I owned it or if I was able to drive it. And, if everything I was doing was for kind of my own benefit, almost that kind of entrepreneurial mindset, I would have the passion to get up early and really want to work on it. As it turned out, it's not that simple. If I'd opened a chicken shop or whatever I was thinking down those lines those days, I don't think I would have been very successful. So I thought, really, what am I good at? And it came back to, maths and stats, right? That's what I learned. That's what I've always kind of been found enjoyable. But I wanted to do it in a way that was maybe a bit more free and a bit more, what I found was exciting. And the other thing is I had to earn a living. So that was quite important. To just skim through the rest, I went across, as Trang mentioned, I went to the US. I jumped onto this Master of Analytics program at Northwestern University. It was one of the first of its kind. I started reading a lot about big data, data science, artificial intelligence, et cetera. And I thought, I spoke to companies like Quantum, et cetera, but I thought I really want to learn it kind of from Silicon Valley and the US where, things are really happening. So I did that. I came back here and I joined Quantium. That was quite an interesting journey for me. I spent probably about 6 months there. It wasn't quite what I was looking for, so I took another kind of mini career break and really tried to focus on what would really matter to me. And I was exposed to some really interesting things in the US and thought, you know, if I don't have a job by the end of the year with something that I really care about, then I'm going to go back to Silicon Valley and we'll see where that takes me. But in the end, I did. I found, as you can see up there, CBIG Consulting. And that kind of ticked a lot of the boxes for me. So I'm by no means trying to herald, hey, you know, this is the best company, go work for them. But that was a really good fit for me, and it continues to be. So for me, it's a success story. However, I guess the kind of overarching motif of this talk is around passion. And the kind of real thing that what I think is important when it comes to passion is it's not something that you find your passion and you're good. It changes all the time. It's a journey. So, you know, maybe I won't be at CBIG in a year's time. Who knows? It kind of depends on where my thinking is at that point. So what does that mean to you? Before I go into that, I kind of wanted to talk a little bit about what kind of passion has done for me. And it's a very kind of, you know, broad term, really. But, you know, going back to where I was, you know, just finished my FIAA, working at PwC, working on some interesting work, but, you know, not feeling that passion. You know, over the last year, my career has really changed a lot, and I'm doing a lot of things that I find are really interesting. I'm going to list some of them, not to blow my own horn or anything, but because I kind of want you to get an idea of kind of when you have that drive behind you, what you can achieve. So I've got, you know, I'm a senior data scientist at CBIG Consulting. That is technically 75% of my time, although I am paid full-time to do that, and that's because they get me. And that's a really interesting job. It involves a lot of training. It involves a lot of kind of going out and building up the practice, growing the practice, et cetera. And it's a really interesting space, and I really do enjoy that job. On top of that, as you can see up there, I co-founded the Minerva Collective, which is a foundation to do data for good. So to take analysts such as yourselves or from you know, various backgrounds, those who are looking to get into data science and analytics, and give them data from charities. And we're also doing a big project with Data Republic, who are a data exchange company, and bringing in a whole lot of different corporate data to find insights, which is something that's never been done before anywhere in the world. So that's pretty cool. I also run, as Trang mentioned, the Sydney Data Science Breakfast Meetup. That happens every 2 or 3 weeks and has over 700 members, I think, at this stage. I just about to launch an internship program for budding data scientists into some different companies. What was the last one? And I also run a startup, a deep learning-driven startup. So all these things, right? It's a lot. It really is a lot. I'm going to add to that, you know, just things I do, and this is something every week. You know, I will take time to study. I'll take time to network, grow my network, maintain my network. I spend time hacking. So at the moment, some of you might be familiar with SQL language. I'm currently building a tool to translate that to English, or rather translate English to SQL in my spare time. I do research, so news, current events, etc., generally with a data science focus. I present at these kinds of events, and I read a lot. So I do have a life, but I just want to kind of get, as I said, give you an idea of, you know, I really find it's really exhausting, I'm not going to lie, but it's not hard. It's something that I want to do. I'm kind of driven to do these things. And, you know, I might be a data nerd or whatever, but it's given me a lot of kind of joie de vivre. So, you know, I think if you can find that passion, it's something really worth holding on to. So I guess the rest of my talk is going to be more around techniques for how to kind of find that within yourself. And everyone's different. I'm not going to prescribe anything. And as I mentioned, I tend to have quite strong opinions about certain things, so I'm going to try not to talk about that at all. But rather, I'm going to, I guess, challenge you with a series of questions. Before I do that, I'll just say, you know, obvious things, and again, not a motivational speech, but, you know, just very generic things like, you know, like thinking about planning, you know, setting yourself goals, thinking about what you really want, you know, speaking to people is a really big thing. I found growing my network has been one of the biggest catalysts for a lot of these things that I've been doing. Which, you know, I'm the same as everyone else here. Like, I don't like running around and talking to people. But, you know, if you force yourself and you have a kind of good reason for doing so, it can be really effective. And another thing I mentioned is if you can find a mentor, that's really helpful. So if you can find someone who's kind of living those things that you hold important, and you can find them and interface with them, then that can be really useful. So what I was going to do was, I guess, put together some kind of predictions or observations about what's kind of happening at the moment within AI, data science, and, you know, to an extent, actuarial, as well as kind of the whole, you know, technology, really. And then we'll start asking some questions. So I'm not asking for any answers, but rather kind of think about some of these. And, you know, if you do have any opinions or thoughts, by all means, you know, ask questions at the end. So, you know, one thing that we're seeing a lot of is automation. So, you know, there's a lot of statistics, you know, this percentage of jobs will be automated, et cetera. Try to think about how that's actually affecting your profession and your day-to-day job and how that could affect it. So, you know, doing things has become a lot cheaper and faster and easier. Not in all cases. Often there's regulatory blockers and things. But generally, you know, one seeing, and particularly with the big tech companies, there's all these new things that are suddenly being done, you know, with the click of a finger. And, you know, think about how that will affect you. You know, I've got a cousin who's an actuary in New York at Ernst & Young, and he kind of keeps talking to me about actuarial robots, and I still don't quite get what he's talking about, but, you know, this is something that sounds pretty, you know, pretty threatening, I guess. You know, robotic process automation within actuarial. Things like cognitive computing, so question answer machines, chatbots, things like that. And, you know, I guess this whole, like, they talk about data science as being the sexiest job of the 21st century. And, you know, within, I've heard statistics put in that same frame. Actuarial is always right at the top of, you know, top job lists and things like that. How is that being reflected in what you're doing? And then, you know, you've got all these different kind of arms races across different industries. So definitely within things like, if you've been following any of the news about image recognition, self-driving cars and all of that, there's this big arms race between big companies there. So try to kind of project that out and think where that's going to land. So within actuarial, and, you know, not being a practicing actuary, I don't have the answers to this at all, but try to think about what kind of advances you're seeing in the field now and where they're going to take you. So what's already happened and what's going to come? And try to think how to position yourself to be well prepared for that. Think about where actuarial adds value. So if you really come, I mean, you know, some of the things Darren was talking about, you know, bottom line of companies, strategic thinking, et cetera, what are you actually trying to achieve and where are you adding value? Where does the actuarial capability fit within organizations and is that going to change? What does a career look like? So if you try to map out your career in future, try to think about how, you know, how that's going to change over time. And I know Rashi's going to talk a little bit about that as well in her own words. Another thing is, you know, the future of work. So, you know, what is a job and will that definition change at all? It's certainly changed a lot in the last 50 years. What can't be automated? So this is something you see a lot in the kind of AI literature. You know, are we all going to be taken over by a super intelligence, or there's some things computers can't do? So what can humans do that computers can't or can't yet? So what happens to things like management, corporate culture, etc., when certain jobs are automated? And yeah, I mean, what will management be like? What will your KPIs be? Again, very open questions, and I'm just trying to kind of get some thoughts flowing. So, yeah, I'm glad there's like kind of silence and thought going on. And try to think about what the ecosystem will look like as the workforce changes. So, you know, how would it work with consultants and vendors and marketers and, you know, things like, you know, within my world at least, and startups and things, open source, meetups, communities, et cetera, how will people communicate? And again, how does your profession kind of either take advantage of that or get threatened by that? And then I guess I want to talk a little bit about, well, ask some questions about the role of the actuarial analyst. So, you know, what kind of organizations need your skills and which don't? So we've heard a lot about non-traditional career paths. You know, you've got actuaries working across the spectrum in a lot of different industries. Try to think about where your skill set is can be best used. And it's not just insurance, obviously. You know, what do people think is the purpose of actuarial and the purpose of kind of data analysis? And, you know, consulting thinking, et cetera. Where does it sit in the business? And does the head of actuarial actually make decisions? And those decisions that they are made, do they own those decisions? And do those decisions actually affect the business in an important way? How is actuarial assessed? So, again, you know, back to KPIs and things like that. In an economic crisis, how will things change? How are actuaries perceived? So I think there's been a bit of talk about that as well. So, you know, particularly not within traditional roles, et cetera, and by the world, et cetera, you know, how are actuaries perceived and how will that change? And who are these people who are perceiving it? And if actuarial were to, you know, diminish or to grow, would people be aware of that? So, yes, sorry if the questions are a bit kind of hard-hitting. I'm just trying to get people to think. So. Look, actuaries in the future, try to think about what the job will actually look like. How has the actuarial profession changed in the last 50 years and how will it continue to change? What skills and characteristics matter? Will there be enough jobs to go around? And if so, why or why not? And lastly, I'll just finish off with saying, you know, again, I guess turning the lens on yourself, think about and challenge yourself to think, you know, is this really what you want to do? And if so, you know, how do you want to do it? What is your kind of archetypal career? And how would you like to quest to do that, to achieve it? How do you want to approach that career? Do you want to be supporting actuarial capacities? Do you want to be managing it? Do you want to be, you know, sitting there doing it? Do you want to be using the effects of actuarial work? Is passion enough? What are you passionate about? When you look above you in your organization, do you see people that you want to emulate? Who are you competing with and are you winning? So I'll just leave you with that and we'll take questions at the end, I guess.
Thanks, Anthony. I hope you wrote down all those questions. I think at last count, you have to answer about 15 of them. So that's going to be very difficult. We're going to come back to that in the panel sessions because I think they were very, very important questions for us to think about. Our next speaker is Greg Bird. Now, Greg is going to cover evolving my personal brand. So this one would be very interesting. Just some background on Greg. He spent most of his career at AMP, starting as an actuarial graduate. Greg has had many roles across AMP, including as General Manager of Strategy and Risk in AMP New Zealand, and then he was also Chief Actuary. He's currently the CFO of Insurance and Superannuation within AMP. So welcome, Greg.
Just a good afternoon. It's just a quick clarification. I've got a new role now at AMP, and it's Director of Insurance Pricing, Data and Risk Analytics. So very appropriate, but literally in the last week. So when the brochure and all this went out for this, I suspected I was going to have a new job, but I thought I'll just wait and tell everyone at this. So that's what I've just done. So I'm going to talk a little bit about my own journey, and I guess it's probably a very consistent theme that you're hearing this afternoon. Talk about my journey, and I guess talk about the brand that I feel I've developed in that journey. And I apologise to some of my AMP colleagues because I'm going to tell some stories now about my own career that they've probably heard, But there is additional information, so hopefully net-net it's beneficial for them as well as it is for the rest of you. So I'm going to represent my career journey graphically. And I guess that's one of the things as actuarial communication is the more pictures and graphs and very simple ways of describing things, I think the better for the audience. So hopefully it works. So please tell me if it doesn't, because I'll evolve my communication skills. So there you go. So the way that I'm going to talk about this over the next sort of 10 or so minutes is how I've moved along this two-dimensional axis of a leadership lens and a sort of technical or business lens. Now, being in a particular part of the quadrant is in no way a reflection of the type of person you are or your personal value or worth to an organisation, but it's just the way I did the graph. And I guess when I started at AMP, I was an actuarial analyst, and that's in that, it's probably a bit way too far in the corner there, hopefully you can see it, but I was in that role for about 3 years, from 2000 to 2003. Started in the systems area, did experience investigations, pleaded with my manager to move into valuation, and the reason for that was because I wanted to understand how valuation worked for the purposes of passing my life insurance exam, to be honest, because I thought I need to understand how MOS works in order to pass the exam. And then from valuation moved into capital management, all while still an analyst, and then eventually into a sort of management reporting style, sort of venturing outside of the actuarial fraternity. And I guess as through that evolution, I guess I probably developed a bit of a brand for myself, and not intentionally, but a brand of being able to speak actuarial things to non-actuaries. And I guess my colleagues and leaders recognised that, and that's why they gave me the opportunities that they did. But also the breadth of the problems I was involved with meant that I got an opportunity to solve a lot of technical problems. So the brand that I guess I had at that time, and in retrospect when I did this presentation, I hadn't actually thought about any of these brand characteristics, but I think that's the way that I would have been seen by my colleagues and leaders. So that's kind of the starting point. In 2003, I actually said at AMP, I'm not really sure I want to keep doing this type of work. I wasn't really sure what it was that I was interested in. But there was something about being a leader or manager of people that I thought I had some interest and maybe some capability, but I didn't know. So I got an initial role in AMP's New Zealand office, and became the manager actuarial. So still some technical components to that. So I managed the valuation team, and pricing was my first exposure to any pricing. And away from the leading of self to a little bit more about leading others, which I was terrible at, to be perfectly honest. I was an awful manager, I think, and maybe I'm not as good today and people need to give me that feedback, but I found the problem with management was that I didn't quite know how to do it in an effective way. I sort of saw the people that were in the team as effectively extensions of what I wanted and what I felt I needed to achieve. I couldn't really feel like I could trust them entirely, not because they were doing anything necessarily wrong, but because I was accountable for what they did. But being a manager is more about understanding that you might be accountable for things that people are doing, but you can't actually direct everything that they're going to do. They're people. And so they need to work out a way in which they're comfortable delivering and you're comfortable with what they do. So I took a lot of feedback on board, received a lot of feedback, a lot of unsolicited feedback quite often about my style. And I guess the two things that I sort of realised at the end of that part of the journey, and that was 4 years, and in that process, AMP moved its office from Wellington to Auckland. For those of you who come from New Zealand, Wellington and Auckland are quite far away from each other. So, but what I realised was it's about being a good coach, listening to people, understanding what it is that's important to them, and organising work, and making people understand the work that the actuarial team is doing is important and valuable, and they've got a lot of things that they can add. So at the end of that one, it seems to happen every 3 or 4 years, actually, as I'm talking about it. I sort of said to my AMP again, I'm not really sure I want to do this anymore, but I'm not really sure what it is I want to do. And AMP accepted that I needed to sort of go out a little bit, and what I did was I went and did some consulting work in London and got an extended leave from AMP for about a year and a half or so. Worked with what was Tillinghast, Towers Watson, Willis Towers Watson, WTW, or I think that's what the acronym now. And that was a great experience. So there was a lot of strategy work I got involved in, stuff that wasn't AMP, which was new to me, and mergers and acquisitions work and just general consulting. But the key thing was I was probably still a leader of some sort, but I actually didn't have people working for me. I had to lead through working with others, so a lot of influencing, a lot of stakeholder management. And by the nature of consulting, you have to get, as a lot of you who work in consulting probably attest to, is that you need to understand things quite quickly and learn about things in a way that makes sense to you. So getting some interest in the wider fields was important. Returned back to AMP in about 2009, ready to say, here I am, I'm an evolved individual now, I've got a fantastic brand, what's my next step here? But it was the middle of the global financial crisis, and unfortunately AMP didn't have a permanent role for me at that stage, and put me on a contract role working on risk management, which I thought, okay, risk management, that's sort of like the data analytics of 2009, sort of everyone wanted to be involved in risk management around that time. So I really got myself into risk management and studied the ERM CIRA course, hit the books again. Worked out the ratios of the number of minutes per mark that I needed to work to pass the exams and all that sort of stuff. So I did all that. But what I'd done is, I guess I had inadvertently spreaded my capability and my brand to be greater than actuarial. So it was risk management. And because of that, I was able to get a role in our New Zealand business, being the general manager of strategy and risk. So I'd done strategy work through consulting, done risk management through the risk work. I'd done some leadership bit before, so I guess on paper I was ready to do a general manager strategy and risk. It was my first business role, I guess you could probably say that. So required strategic thinking and obviously the risk management skills that I learnt, had to refresh an ERM framework in the New Zealand business, but it was my exposure to what business really is, which is that it's challenging, people have very high expectations of you. And if you're an actuary, it's not really that relevant. In fact, they get really annoyed about the fact if you remind them that you're an actuary, because it makes them think that you know something that they don't know. Now, that's not to say the business side of things is all scary, but you just need to remember that you're amongst everyone else, and you've got to identify what your personal value is that you're going to bring to whatever the problem is. So that set me up well to move into a little bit more of a business role. But the next step actually was kind of a bit backwards from a business perspective. I moved into the chief actuary role in our New Zealand business. It was my first role where I was leading leaders. So that was leading people who were leaders of people. Leadership really became then how do I develop a vision and a strategy and help my team lead their own teams through that. So being a trusted leader was very important, and the fact that I had a lot of technical knowledge, a lot of experience in life insurance and some people management, I was able to be trusted by the business to lead the organisation, or lead the actuarial team, at least in the organisation, and the changes that it needed to go through. So from New Zealand, back to Australia again now. So I actually married a New Zealander. When did I do that? That was in 2008 when we were in London. We went to New Zealand, had our first child, had a second child whilst in New Zealand, and then Australia called again, and this role came up in the AMP Australia office. Very similar, I guess, in terms of the overall responsibilities of the chief actuary role, but a much bigger organisation, bigger part of AMP, I should say, bigger team, and somewhat more complex business problems to solve, and AMP facing similar issues to MLC and a lot of the life insurance industry. So worked my way through that and led the team through that up until last week when I was doing that role, and now I'm doing a different role, which is this role. And I don't really know, I guess, where, if I was to draw this diagram and come back and speak to you in 2 years' time, where I'd go. Maybe it won't be up that way, maybe in a different direction. But I guess probably the point of that is that I didn't know what particular brand characteristics I was going to develop or leverage or whatever before I started the role. I guess that became clear to me once I was doing the role, and very clear to me once I'd finished it. But I guess what I did know is that with each step that I was taking, there were things that I felt that I could learn about myself and what I could add to the company. And I think that that's sometimes the only thing that you can really do. And that's kind of what I'm doing right now in terms of the new role that I've got. So hopefully it works out. So that was all I was going to talk about. And I guess am I handing back?
So just coming back to our theme of strategic leadership, if you don't already know, even APRA is getting onto this topic for actuaries, particularly in the life insurance arena. So they've had discussion papers, discussion meetings with actuaries about our role as strategic leaders inside organisations. And we've got Rashi Bansal today to talk about that, and her topic is Strategic Actuaries, the APRA proposal, and she will share some of her experience and thinking around that. If you don't know Rashi, she is currently the Chief Actuary and the Head of Finance at BT Financial Group. She leads the actuarial and finance teams there. She is the appointed actuary for Westpac's GI and Lenders Mortgage Insurance business. And prior to BT, she was at PwC, in the actuarial consulting, specialising in accident compensation. And she's had, obviously, in her 20 years of experience, a lot of exposure to strategic operational planning. So welcome, Rashi.
Thank you, Trang. So it's not easy being the last speaker of the day, just between drinks and that, so I'm going to keep it short. I'll try and finish on time. So Trang's actually asked me to speak from an APRA lens. I just want to start off by saying these are my personal views. They're not BT's view or the Institute of Actuaries' views, because I know there's been lots of submissions on that. So there can be quite a lot of different views out there. So I thought I'd kick off by just commenting on APRA and the fact that they've actually felt that they need to come in with a discussion paper over the last year, where they actually focused really on the strategic role of the actuary. So what they did was they felt that there was a lot more work that the actuary could do, especially the appointed actuary, and they could get a seat at the table where they could really drive, in their own words, allow the AA greater capacity to play a strategic role within insurers. In my view, I think the role of all actuaries, and especially the head of the actuarial team and the appointed actuary, have a really critical role, a really critical strategic role in leading the company through all its strategic activities and its strategic direction as well. So I guess I'm really excited that APRA has kind of come up with this proposal, but then I also kind of self-reflect thinking, what have we done which has meant that APRA's had to come out and put this on the table and asking insurers to do this? I'd like actuarial profession to kind of feel that they can earn a seat at the table and they don't need a regulator to come and do this on their behalf. So I think there's a bit of self-reflection opportunity there. What I've just put on my first slide is the proposed purpose statement that APRA's put out. So this is the purpose statement that they've asked for feedback on, and they've actually said they'll include this either in regulatory standards or they want insurers to include them in some format in their own advice framework. And I've underlined a few words. To be honest, the first time I did this, I underlined the whole thing. So then I thought I'd call back a little bit and underline a few key words. And again, the focus really is on the strategic actuary. There's a huge, huge demand that the actuary gets involved in all aspects of the company, of the insurance company, and helps them drive the strategic direction, debate of strategic issues at the executive level, and they play a key role. So that's where I want to start off with. I also want to quote a Deloitte survey that I read about last year in 2016, and what they did was they collected 2 years of data. Correct me if I'm wrong. They collected 2 years of data, over 100 actuarial functions is who they surveyed. And what they found was most of those actuarial functions and the actuaries involved in that said their roles have really become a steward and an operational role over time, but they really, really want to get back involved as a catalyst and a strategist. in the company. So there's a huge opportunity for us to go back into those roles if we're not there. And I know there's lots of challenges that we currently face from a regulatory perspective, a compliance burden that we have that actually doesn't really help in us actually going back to those roles. But the challenge is on us to see how we can get back there. And I think there's a huge, huge benefit that companies and insurance companies can gain from this, because what they'll see is an improvement in their performance. They'll see an improvement in their positioning in the industry. And I think the consumer market also will see a benefit from this, because we really can bring, you know, Darren talked about the control cycle. We really can bring that holistic view around, and I speak for insurance, but I think it can be applied to many things, data science, for example, that Anthony talked about as well. But we can bring this holistic view, end-to-end view, with our training to benefit the customers as well. So that's where I want to start. So where is the next challenge for us? What are the attributes that we need to be able to call ourselves strategic actuaries? To me, that's no different to what are the attributes of a strategic leader. I say that actuaries, and especially at the senior level, we should be strategic leaders, we should be leading the team, and we should also play a key management role. Now, I've got quite a few attributes there. I'm not going to go through all of them. I wanted to focus on three of them, and the three that are most closest to my heart, and I feel like, you know, are really, really important and have been a key driving force in my career. So the first one is resilience. You know, these are key buzzwords. I'm sure everyone's heard them. If you Google attributes of strategic people or, you know, some of those key kind of management words, you'll get resilience as one of the key attributes. I actually really take that really to heart. I think it is a real key attribute. And I've only really realized that in the last couple of years of my career. I think before that, I was easily kind of put down by failures. But now I kind of realize those failures actually make you stronger. You actually learn from them. Think of them as this fantastic opportunity to get real life experience and get feedback as well. So, and it actually helps you with your EQ as well. So you really, you become more perceptive, you learn from things. And I remember a few years ago, I said to my people leader, this was the worst year I ever had. Hope I never have this again, you know. But, and he said, look, you know, you'll have more of these years, but it'll actually make you stronger. Think of them as battle scars. And I have had a lot of battle scars over the last 20 years, but I've actually, it's given me the courage to think, well, I can actually deal with all challenges going forward. And, you know, we just need to kind of go back to your training, go back to your skill set, go back to your network and see how you can actually leverage all of those to get through with that. So I think resilience is one of the key ones that I've called out there. The other one is building relationships, and you hear networking a lot. Anthony talked about networking. You cannot underestimate the value of networking. I wish someone told me this earlier on in my career. I think I used to think of it as a buzzword. You know, I'm an introvert by nature, and I thought, oh, well, it's for extroverts. It's not really for me. Not everyone needs to network. But I think you have to teach yourself to network. You have to teach yourself to build relationships, and you've got to do it to your own level of comfort. So the work networking actually creates discomfort for a lot of people, and I think it actually creates some discomfort for a lot of actuaries. You've actually got to think of how you can actually surpass that discomfort and create a network for yourself. And observe the way different people do it. Think of things that you could do. Challenge yourself and say, look, you know, I would have come to this conference. I would have kind of spoken to the people I already know. I would have sat with my friends. At drinks time, I would have grabbed a drink, and 15 minutes on, I'd leave. I challenge everyone to stay, introduce themselves to new people, and actually follow up on it. So the benefits of networking are really if you follow up on it. And it's not about you making a network or making a relationship so that you feel like, you know, you have something to gain from it. Actually, the other person gains more from it than you do. You actually are there helping them as well. So networking is a really, really important thing, and I encourage everyone to do it. I'm actually, I'd say in the last 5 years, I've realized how important it is, and I put myself out there a lot more than I ever did. I think 5 years ago, if someone asked me to come and speak at a conference, I would have just gone, no way am I putting myself out there and talking to people. Whereas now, I think, you know, it's something that you have to do. Be on committees, volunteer. So Trang's already given you an opportunity if you want to write an article. Put your hand up, see what can come from it, and go for it. And think of it as networking within the industry and your profession, but also within the company and within your colleagues as well. So think of how you can do that. I'm very adamant of having at least 2 catch-ups with my business, so the BT network, every week. And you've got to make time for that, and you've got to follow up on those connections as well. So that's the second thing. The third thing, I think, and I think this was covered quite a bit by our speakers, you've just got to have this you've got to have this curiosity and this passion for learning. You've got to see what's out there that you can still learn and grasp all those opportunities, exploit all those opportunities. So if something comes up, don't shy away from it. Don't think, well, that's not my skill set, I don't know about it. I think you really have to kind of say, well, what can I learn from it? Who can I depend on to kind of give me that? I learn by observing other people, so it's always about seeing who I can talk to get their tips and skills. So I'm on this project at the moment, and I've never done anything like that at the moment before. And the first thing I did was I went and asked a few people, who can I go talk to get some tips from them as to where do I start, where do I go about. I Googled a few things and off you go. So have this, be really insightful, have a curiosity for learning, have a passion for learning, make it something that really excites you. And the change we're going through in the insurance environment at the moment is dramatic. So we are going through so much change that I think none of us can really shy away from learning new things, grasping new opportunities and seeing how we can actually better ourselves, better the actuarial profession and actually get that, you know, seat at the table being a strategic leader. Because if you don't go with the change, you never will be able to kind of keep that seat at the table. Has anyone seen the movie Hidden Figures? Yeah, Hidden Figures, yeah. So even back in that day, this is like 40 years ago, you could see that the three ladies, especially the one, the IT one, she actually took on the challenge of those big IBM machines. And, you know, we sit here and laugh at that, but imagine how challenging that was for them then. I think we're in a similar situation. Anthony talked about automation, digitization, robotics, artificial intelligence, data scientists, and the amount of reg change and social change and customer expectations on our industry are so huge. You really need to grasp onto that attribute. From a personal example I want to share with you, I'm a general insurance actuary by background. I spent the first 15 years of my career doing pure general insurance work through a range of things, firstly a PwC, then a BT. In 2013, I got the opportunity to apply for a chief actuary role that actually encapsulated life insurance as well. Now, my first reaction was, I know nothing about life insurance. GI actuaries don't talk to life actuaries. There's no way I could learn. I can't be a life insurance actuary. But I think you really have to kind of grasp those opportunities, which is what I did. I felt like I needed a lot of push to do that, and I shouldn't have needed that push. I should have trusted in my own skill set. And I'm never going to be a technical life insurance actuary. I can't do profit funds and I can only explain MOS to a certain degree. But what you bring is a strategic lens to the business. So now my role encapsulates general insurance, lenders mortgage insurance and also life insurance. And similarly, last year I got the opportunity to take on, so obviously I've been in a very traditional actuarial field across all areas, but last year I also took on finance. So now I have the finance team reporting through to me as well. And again, you kind of go, my first comment to my CFO when she actually breached the topic with me was, oh, I don't know how to do ledger journals. I've forgotten accounting 1A and 1B. But really, we don't need to do that anymore. What we need to do is, again, go back to our skill set and see how we can leverage that going forward. So I wanted to share that with you about the attributes of strategic actuaries. Now, the last slide, Trang asked me to kind of comment on some of the challenges we face. And some of these words are, again, I think quite, they shouldn't come as a surprise to anyone. I think the biggest challenge we face is communication. So communication is one of the most key attributes that we need to make sure we can be strategic and well-rounded actuaries. And we really can, the things I talked about in the first slide, we really can fulfill all of those. Verbal communication, written communication, actually presenting ideas, the complex thinking that Greg talked about as well. We need to make sure we can actually simplify that and actually explain that in simple terms to a different wide range of audience. Look, there's no easy answer to this. It's you obviously can go to training courses, you can do lots of, you know, different kind of modules and all of that, but I feel like the best way to do it is on-the-job training. Observe from the leaders that you see do this really well. Develop your own style. Challenge yourself. Don't shy away from it. See how you can actually even start off by, if someone asks you a question, see if you can repeat that in simple terms and give an answer in simple terms, like two or three sentences without going into the detail. We have lots of actuaries at BT, and I think you can still see that some people still need to, when you talk to them, an answer cannot be two sentences. It will be like a whole, you know, 5-minute discussion, because they'll give you all the terms and conditions and the assumptions that go with it. So you can't just have a conclusion without that. See how you can challenge yourself to feel comfortable, because I know a lot of people say, well, no, I have to tell you these are things that you also should keep in mind. See how you can shorten that. See how you can be more clearer in your communication around that. We are seen as technical experts, and that kind of is a conception as well that we bring when we have discussions with people, discussions with management, discussions with board, and with the executive team members. There's a bit of a mystique associated with that. Let's see if we can break that mystique down. I think it's fantastic that we have this technical capability and technical knowledge. Let's see if we can kind of park that a little bit when we do the communication and really kind of try and talk to them in their language, try and explain things in their language, see how they can actually understand that. I think I was reading this article from Martin Mulcair actually just a couple of days ago, and he said PowerPoint is not an actuary's friend. And PowerPoint is everyone's friend. That's just the new way of working. But I think he was commenting that actuaries really struggle to find, to use PowerPoint because they can't actually put two or three bullet points of the clear findings, because if they do that, they'll have five pages of notes behind it. And so let's see if we can challenge that status quo and actually get that clear thinking in there. I'm not going to spend too much time. I think the previous speakers have really spoken about getting a seat at the table, and I've covered that up a little bit as well. We really need to earn that seat at the table, build your relationships, let people know how much you know, how much you care, how passionate you are about the business, and you will actually get that seat at the table. I think you really need to earn it, and then you actually will keep it for longer as well. It's great that APRA's got this discussion paper out there, and they're focusing on it as well, but actuaries as a profession need to actually earn that. Keep focusing on your networking skills and relationships, and let's see if we can break down some of these preconceived notions and ideas of us being too prescriptive and too conservative in everything we do. We just need to keep it top of mind. There's no easy answer on this is how you do it. You just need to keep it top of mind and find your own way of breaking them down. And I think the only other thing I'd say is I feel like I've been really, really lucky. I've had 20 years in the profession. You know, I've gone through some cycles, ups and downs. I probably wasn't performing my best all through those 20 years, but the grasp onto any challenge, opportunities that you get, and you really see what you can make of them. Don't shy away from them. Wrap your arms around all of them and just try it out. So for me, I've got a fantastic mentor who I use as a sounding board, and I think that's really, really good. Anthony covered that off as well. I think mentors and sponsors are awesome, and you know, use this opportunity to see if you can find one as well. So it's great to have one from your company. It's great to have one from the industry as well. So I'll finish with that and pass back to Trent.
Do you know what I find really interesting? We get some very senior leaders here presenting to us, and when we talk about leaders, we know they need to be authentic, and that's the sign of a true leader. And I think Rashi giving us the examples of the challenges she's gone through, and the fact that even at a very successful level, by all our standards, you know, she still has a mentor and still accesses that. I think that's a great learning for us that, you know, this leadership journey goes on well beyond the point at which you might see them as already being successful. So thank you, Rashi, for that. I just want to invite our speakers to come to the front while you all prepare your questions, because I did give you a warning for this. So hopefully everyone's jotted down their questions. So the microphones are going around. Does anyone want to start? Helena, thank you. And please state your name and your company. Depending on the question, maybe leave the company out.
I'm Helena and I'm from Deloitte. Rashi and Darren spoke about the strategic role of the actuary, particularly in traditional actuarial areas like insurance. I was just wondering what your opinions are on their strategic role in non-traditional areas and whether or not industry would be receptive to that sort of involvement from an actuary?
I think the reason that actuaries do have a strategic role within life insurance companies is because of the quantitative and analytical element that we bring. And when we talk about those things, there's a deep thirst for it. So, you know, as actuaries, we tend to hold back a little bit. But I find when we give out that information, it's really well demanded. So that's within ours. And I've no doubt that the same effects would occur in other... I think generally, I mean, we all think in a very quantitative way, but most people actually don't. And we also think in a very long-term, with long-term horizons, which most people don't as well. And so because of that, our opinions are generally valued in a commercial environment where those qualities matter.
Look, Helena, I think it's a great question. I actually personally feel that actuaries can add value in a strategic level, especially across all businesses, not just insurance and not just traditional superannuation areas as well. I think to Darren's point, I think we have this excellent training. We've got these great mind of thinking, the way we think and the way we kind of put problems together and try and solve them, which everyone can value from. I think it's about actually getting the experience in those industries so you can actually get that seat at the table at the strategic level across all industries. I obviously work at BT, which is the wealth management company of Westpac, and it's a huge corporation with lots of non-traditional areas as well. And what I found is the value that we can bring and the demand that we have for the actuarial team and my team across all of Westpac, once they get to know you, you build those relationships, they see the value, is actually amazing. So I get calls all the time saying, do we have any actuaries who can second into their teams? And these are very non-traditional, out-of-the-box thinking. And it's not just quant areas. It's actually, you know, different areas of treasury as well that are doing kind of different new interesting projects. So I think there's definitely a demand and value that we can add.
Hi, I'm Angela. I'm from MLC. I just want to ask Anthony, you mentioned you went to US and studied for half a year there, and would you mind sharing your opinions? What are the comparative advantages you obtained from US and as opposed to people who, like say, doing some online courses at home country? Thank you.
Sure. Yeah, I was there for a year and a half, so it was a bit longer than that. It was also pre-Trump, so I don't know what the effect of that is. The differences I found was, I mean, it depended. The university I was at was excellent. It was a private university, had enormous amounts of funding that you just don't find in other countries usually. Just from an educational perspective, it was really, really good. But in terms of, I mean, it's difficult to say because I think there are some slight differences between Americans and Australians and I guess people from different countries. And I think Australians are, you know, can be very innovative and a lot of very, I mean, something like the internet was invented in Australia. You know, there is a certain, kind of innovative capacity that Australians inherently have. Which, you know, they talk about a lot in Silicon Valley, but, you know, you see them borne out a lot here. So it's a complicated question, but I think, you know, I got something from there and I came back and tried to find ways to apply it here. So I hope that helps.
Hi, James from Deloitte. I had a question for Greg on brand. From your story, it looked like your brand grew very naturally, it was a natural evolution. I was wondering, is there a principle or a framework you use to guide how your brand grew? And then the second part of the question is, how do you kind of market that to build credibility and reliability in other people on how your brand is shown?
You can hear this, yeah. So I guess the way I think about it now is that I always look ahead in terms of what would I like to be doing to keep myself interested and busy and have meaning in what I do a long way out. And then I think, well, what is it that I can do now that might be in effort of that? So did I think that I wanted to do the current role that I was doing when I was an actuarial analyst? No way, and I probably would actually be quite frightened about that at the time, just like looking ahead to roles that I might be interested in 10 years' time, and I'll be thinking, no way, I'm not ready for that now. But what I am ready for is what might that next step be? So I guess that's the way that I think about things now, and I guess you could call that a framework. And I guess in terms of marketing that, I think it's a matter of just being in service of others and the organisation is the way that I guess I think about it, that if what I'm doing is of shared interest to me and shared interest to the organisation, then it's beneficial for both of us. And as long as I can find ways that the brand, my brand aligns to the organisation's brand, then I think it works. I think when you run into problems is when you want something that's out of line with what the organisation or your team or whatever wants. That's when you've got an issue. But if you align it up, then it normally works.
Can I just add to what Greg has just said? So at Deloitte, we have this term, aim to be famous. But when you say that, that's actually really scary. So this is about the personal brand building. So I think to Darren's talk, and you would have seen that slide, the very first thing you can do as a young actuary in a team is to actually build credibility. So within your team, within your chief actuary, they need to be able to see that you are reliable, you're credible, and you can actually deliver, and the rest of it will just come. So start with something manageable rather than, you know, aim to be famous. It can get a bit scary. Other questions from the floor, please?
Thanks. Marcello from Infinity Consulting. Presumably there's other professions that are encouraging its members to be strategic leaders. So it's sort of a competitive environment at that strategic leadership level, whether it's board or executive. So actuaries are sort of up against other professions. Do you think we should focus on our strengths or focus on our weaknesses to give it to be more well-rounded to compete in that environment?
Look, I think there's different thoughts out there as to what people, the way they kind of train themselves. So I know there's lots of different kind of instruments and surveys that you take that tells you your strengths and you say, these are your weaknesses, focus on these are your strengths, focus on this. I'm a believer of you should focus on your strengths. I think the actuarial profession has these amazing strengths and amazing capabilities, and I think that's what we need to leverage with the softer skills to be able to compete in the industry with all different kind of lead professions as well, lawyers, risk professionals, which I guess actuaries are as well, but, you know, all the different professions. So I'd say focus on your strengths and combine that with a really solid kind of grounding of communication skills, resilience, being accountable, all of those kind of, you know, softer skill sets, and we're really, really well placed in the marketplace.
Do you think that's what boards and executives want? Like the focus on strengths, or do you reckon they want well-rounded people?
Actually, maybe I should pass to my director. What do you think boards want?
Good question. I think they do want people who understand their subject matter. I think more and more you want management who does understand a little bit of the detail. You know, we had a whole move away from don't dive into the detail, but I think we've had a move back to, you know, we want you to manage and lead, but we also want you to understand what's going on in your business. I would just reiterate your points, actually. Then you've got to combine that with the communication skills, all of that softer. But, you know, at the end of the day, I think actuaries, you know, we're sought after because we're clever. Don't shy away from that.
And I'd just reinforce those points as well. I think you definitely want to focus on your strengths rather than your weaknesses. The boards that I've been in are very focused in their questioning on who they're asking. So they ask a particular question and they'll direct it to whoever is the expert in that particular area. This ties back to a lot of what Rashi was saying. Latest research is saying more important than intelligence in success is this new term called grit or resilience. And it's the ability to just keep focused and being passionate about a particular thing. And that's all about focusing on your strengths and the things that you love.
And can I add to that as well? Because Darren and I have debated on this many times and we don't always agree. So there's a book called The Extraordinary Leader, and it talks about leveraging your strengths, but what's really important is to be very self-aware of your weaknesses, but it's about using those strengths to lift up those weaknesses. And everyone has developmental points at every level, but what's really important is in a particular role, you have certain responsibilities. If those are seen, if your weaknesses are seen to be fatal flaws, then they do need to be dealt with. If you are in a role where you're leading people, for example, and you're mentoring them and you're in charge of their performance and you're not great with people, then I would call that a fatal flaw. So it's about leveraging your strengths, but there will be certain things that you will need in your role as a leader that you will need to still build.
So this is Shimon from RGA. A question for Greg. So during your presentation, you said you were not an effective manager in the early years of your career. However, in hindsight, from that experience, I think you are a good manager now. So I'm just assuming, sorry, from that experience.
Like, you can ask some people around here if they think that.
The question is, despite that experience, what are some of the challenges you face in people management?
So I think that defining a vision and strategy that's meaningful to people, that's not just meaningful to you and your bosses, but something that has meaning to everybody. I think keeping people engaged in a very sort of changing or challenging time, to be able to stay focused on important elements of the job. And not be distracted about things that might be uncertain or difficult, and keeping people focused on that. And I guess probably the other thing is always looking at how you. It's a challenge about how you can develop others. It's great that I can look at my own personal journey and say, well, this is what worked for me, but it's not necessarily going to be the case for most, if anyone that's in any of my teams. So I need to be aware and acute to what's important to them, stay up to date with them and their own personal journey, and try and guide them in a way that's meaningful to them. So staying on top of that is also a challenge, but that's what makes it enjoyable, I guess.
I'm going to let the floor have one more question, if anyone wants a last question.
Okay, just a quick question. Do you guys feel that the actuarial brand has been hurt in terms of what's happened recently, in terms of profitability in the life insurance sector? I mean, we talked about credibility, and you know, if you look at the performance in the industry in general, it hasn't been great. And a lot of people look at actuaries and say, well, those are the guys who should know what's going on. And in many ways, do you feel that we have hurt our own brand? Just in general?
So I'll have a go. Have we hurt the brand of actuaries? I don't think so. I guess one of the things that, let me use the example of the slides that I put up and the way that it gets presented. There's always a way in which things can seem and should be seen as a smooth, easy journey, but it's not like that. And there's always going to be instances when an industry or a person or a team is going through a challenging time. Does that mean that they've failed or that they've not done the right thing? Not necessarily. What I think defines the person or the team is how they respond to that failure, and if they're able to learn from it and help whoever they're working with to get to the next step up the ladder, I think that's what we're potentially facing now. That's not unique to actuaries. It's not unique to insurance. That's sort of humanity, I guess. So I don't think it's damaged it. And I think the fact that we're able to talk confidently about what those learning opportunities are and not shy away from them is another example of how we're in a good position for people to regard what we're saying.
I mean, there are a lot of competitive pressures that
and environmental issues that went into the profitability that emerged. There's a lot of political issues. At the end of the day, I mean, I don't want to shy away from it too much, but the particularly the appointed actuary, their role isn't actually to make decisions. Their role is to provide advice to the board. That's the way APRA have set it up. And in that context, I think they have done that. I do have a bit of an issue around timeliness of information, and that could have been improved. But at the end of the day, the outcomes didn't arise because of the actuarial approach or the techniques that we use, but rather because human fundamental flaws around greed and fear. And looking for the next deal when actually there's a need for caution.
Thanks, Darren. I just wanted to thank our speakers today. As you can see, it's a significant investment of their time to come here to speak to us. So I just wanted to thank you again to Darren, to Greg, Anthony and Rashi. And I've got your wine here. It's $10 a bottle, please. I'd just like to invite Nicolette back, please, to close the session. Thanks, Nicolette.
Thanks, Trang. It's my job now to close the conference. I think it's been a wonderful day, really. I've personally got a lot out of it, and I hope you all have. Some of the highlights for me were the working overseas section. So I thought Jazz gave a great bird's eye view, quite incredible that he could summarise all the different countries like he did. And Liz and Ray, just an amazing breadth of experience working overseas. I also liked the session Zahn and Alice gave on the actuarial skills and how you use them in not-for-profit. That was quite inspiring. Got a lot out of the communication session. I just wanted to reiterate, if there's one book that you buy, that Barbara Minto book on the Pyramid Principle is excellent. It's gold, actually, in my mind from a communications point of view. I've actually had dinner with Barbara Minto at one stage. And I'm afraid I missed a lot of this last session, but judging by the questions that were coming out, just that last question on whether we've had any damage to our profession, I think I agree with Greg's answer. We actually haven't. We've seemed to have avoided that. But I was in a media round table where a very well-known journo did actually ask us directly, what the hell we were up to. So I do think there is a danger of that, particularly if there's further issues. So I will just now go to a few thank yous. So firstly, a big thank you to our, I wonder if there is another, oh no, there we go. Thank you to our sponsors again, Affinity and SKL. I'm sure they've actually been very happy to be associated with this event. And I would like to just invite up Melissa Tam from Affinity and Jaz Singh from SKL to receive their certificates. Ta-da! Thank you. They've not got names on them. Oh, yeah. They do have names on them.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Very much appreciate your involvement. Oh, and a photo. So because it's our first ever Young Actuaries Conference, we are very, very keen to get your feedback, and I can assure you that the Council will be looking very closely at that. So I believe you've received a text today, but that you will also get an email. So please, please, please let us know. And we very much welcome you to future Actuaries Institute events. And I understand there's one coming up on the 1st of August, being the GI Glimpse, also being held here. So please mark that in your diaries. And then I just wanted to thank all of our plenary speakers, our facilitators, and a particular thank you to the members of the organising committee. I'm just wondering if we can actually get them to stand up. I mean, they've actually been involved throughout the day, but Gia Tan, who is the convener. Is Gia around? Nope. All right. Avanti, who we saw earlier. Where's Avanti gone? Jaz Singh, Tim Lam, Peter Corbett, Trang, Brendan Jones, Mattia. This is a test to see whether they last the distance. Yeah. Victor Gao. Victor here. Victoria. Sorry, not Victor. Victoria. Right. Anyway, thank you. I think you've done an excellent job, all of you. I also want to... and a thank you to the Institute's events team who've pulled this all together, and to the HQ staff who always chip in at this when we do a big event like this. So thank you very much to you. And now I would simply like to invite you all to come for drinks until 6 p.m. That would be great. That's when you will turn into pumpkins. Thank you.